Talking with author and publisher, movie producer, and paranormal investigator Tim Beckley, who has traveled the world in search of the unexplained. He's had encounters with men in black. He's reported three different UFO sightings. He's lived in a haunted house, and he has turned his talents and that of his writing team to a different subject. Our Hollow Earth is the name of a subject matter of a new book that he's got out. I don't know if, like me, you first read Jules Verne's rollicking adventure story, A Journey to the Center of the Earth, as a kid, or whether you read it as an adult, or you just know it from a couple of pretty decent movies. The earlier one, the original one that I saw, had James Mason in it, and then Brendan Fraser, I think, did a couple of later ones. You know the basic story, though, the idea that there is another world, another Earth, another civilization under our feet, deep inside the planet. Is that a preposterous idea, a myth? Is it born of religious beliefs that it is an actual literal hell down there? We're going to ask Tim Beckley in a moment to tie it all together for us and tell us what he's found. We'll be right back. Timothy Green Beckley has been chasing strange mysteries and odd stories all over the world for decades. He's turned his attention and that of his writing team to the subject of Our Hollow Earth, an inner world paradise or a gateway to hell. Welcome back to the program, Tim.
Well, good, George. Nice to be on again. I think I want to explain right off the top that we're talking about several different concepts when we talk about the Hollow Earth or the Inner Earth mystery. It's thought that the Earth is actually multi-layered, and that there is a heaven inside the Earth, a paradise, and to others it is a real living hell that exists below our feet. Now, this includes the Shaver mystery, Admiral Byrd and the Hollow Earth, and even the UFO crash at Roswell, as far as I'm concerned, and there's even a possible Kennedy assassination link. So there's a quite a tidy globe here to uncover.
Oh, yeah. We're going to try to cover all of it. It was a lot to chew on here. I enjoyed the book. There's a lot of discussion about flat Earth, which I have trouble with.
Oh,
Hollow Earth.
Yes. I always thought that the flat Earth, even back in the days where supposedly people thought that the Earth was flat, was a hoax, that it was created by these explorers and the different kings and queens that sent the explorers out in search of gold and spices and other riches, because they wanted to tell the other explorers to keep away, that they would fall off the side of the Earth, when they knew all well and good that the Earth really was not flat. And there's no evidence that one can actually point to. I mean, all you have to do is look through a telescope at the other planets in the solar system, and you can see they're not flat. I mean, it's just that's a preposterous theory. Now, some people might say that about the Hollow Earth as well. But it's a little bit easier for me to swallow, because we might also be dealing with the parallel universes here. Everything that we talk about tonight may not be in the physical plane.
Oh, that's interesting. So, but I put it in a different category than flat Earth. We're pretty sure. In fact, we're absolutely positive that the Earth is not flat. But the Hollow Earth, Earth is big. There are a lot of really deep holes, and I'm interested in some of the angles that you pursued in this, Admiral Byrd and others who are serious people who have looked into this in a serious way. Let's start with it sort of on a mythological and religious level first, though. The story about the people living underground, I mean, it's a fictional story, it's in novels, it's in movies, but it's been around with humans for a long, long time, another.
Yes. Fellow who I guess you could say discovered Halley's comet, Mr. Halley. I have a photo, a painting of him, a portrait in my office, which shows him holding a illustration of the Hollow Earth. He was a big believer in the planet being hollow, and that there was a central sun and a globe, civilization possibly existing inside the planet. Also around 25 or so, there was another fellow by the name of Simmons who actually tried to get the U.S. Congress to put up a to fund an expedition into the hollow Earth. And they did take him seriously, but they died before his proposal could take root. Now, Admiral Byrd saw it mainly the South and the North Pole for military purposes, he said, you know, later on when interviewed. But the concept of the Earth being a hollow, as you point out, goes back many, many years. In fact, a part of this book, Our Hollow Earth, we found a manuscript that goes back, I think about 150 years before the one that Jules Verne wrote. It was written by a Danish university professor who claimed that he actually fell inside a cave. And inside the cave, he was led to this world inside of our own planet. And he encountered, he says, some very strange beings and some very strange plants. And so the book has been translated, but it was never really widely distributed. And we came across the copy and polished it up a little and included it as part of this Our Hollow Earth book. So it has become a part of the legend and lore. Of course, I would suppose that the Jules Verne book and the movies, which starred the one movie starred Pat Boone was in it, by the way.
Right.
You know, probably did a lot to foster this idea. But there have been other authors, including H.P. Lovecraft, of course, wrote about a lot of things that went inside, happened inside the earth and in the oceans and so forth. And probably most famous of all, Edgar Rice Burroughs. Wrote about it in somewhat of a serious notion. So people ask me, well, when did the concept start? Well, I tried to do some research on this, and I was not really able to find out. It seems to go back as long as there is a recorded literature.
Yeah, I mean, you've got examples in the book from Greek mythology, the three-headed hound of hell that guarded the underworld.
Our contributor, Hercules Invictus, is a great scholar when it comes to a Greek mythology. In fact, he claims that the Greek gods actually live in caverns beneath Mount Olympus, and that they still exist to this very day. And from time to time, they actually depart their cavern dwellings and go visit the local islands there in Greece.
Of course, Christianity has hell, a literal hell where people go and pay for their sins through all eternity. And when you think about it in a literal sense, they think about it as being underground. And it seems like the Greeks thought there was Hades, and it seems like most of the major religions and cultures have some kind of a dark underworld somewhere buried in the earth. It goes way, way back. Is there any culture that doesn't have it?
Well, you know, now my mentor to a large degree in this was a fellow a publisher by the name of Raymond A. Palmer. Back in late 1930s, early 1940s, he was editor of a science fiction magazine called Amazing Stories, which he was a rather young man at the time, and they had hired him to be the editor. Their office is Ziff Davis, a very big publishing company, later over the years, was headquartered in Chicago. Now, the bulk of the material in Amazing Stories was about futuristic space travel. I mean, that's what the readers wanted to read. And the circulation, is printed on the cheap newsprint, and the circulation was rather limited. In fact, it was more so limited because it was during the period of World War II, and paper was being rationed. Anyway, one day while Ray Palmer was out of the office, a big manila envelope arrived, and it was opened by his assistant editor, a fellow by the name of Bob Brown, I believe. And he read the first page of the manuscript. It purported to be from a Richard Shaver, who supposedly was hearing voices and said that there was an ancient civilization that was living inside the earth. And he took the manuscript and he tossed it in the waste basket because, first of all, Amazing Stories was supposed to be a science fiction publication. This was sent in as a legitimate story about archaeology and supposedly with a scientific bent, although it would highly be placed in that category. Well, when Ray Palmer came into the office, I guess he noticed the thick envelope sitting on top of the waste paper basket, and he picked it up and he read the first couple of pages, and he saw something in it. And he decided to rewrite the work. Schaber was not a very good writer, to say the least, because I know I edited his stuff from time to time. But Palmer saw that there was a something with the manuscript that just was something that he believed in. There was something there that held some truth. And he decided to have it rewritten and published it in the magazine as I remember Lemuria. Now, the manuscript was about a race of beings called the Titans, who had come from another planet, and they had inhabited or were doing trade with the people that lived here on this planet back in the days of Lemuria and Atlantis and Pan, if you want to accept those as being existing continents. But they were their lifespan was being decreased because there was radiation coming from the sun. So in fact, according to the biblical scholars, there was once a canopy that existed over the earth that protected us from this solar radiation. And anyway, the Titans, some of them decided to go back to the planet that they came from, and others bored inside the earth. Apparently, there was even a tunnel system that existed below that went back before they had even arrived. I don't know how many eons or thousands of years, and they set up a headquarters there. But being out of the rays of the sun, they went a little bit, shall we say, they became mutants and went a little bit mad, to say the least. And Shaver claims that he heard voices. And these voices were coming from this cavern world, and that he believed that the Dero, he called this race of beings, were responsible for all sorts of woes to humanity, that they filled our minds with murderous thoughts, caused wars, disasters such as plane crashes, train wrecks, and death via some ancient laser-like weapons that they had captured from the Titans, or kept there from the Titans. And of course, now people thought that he was a little bit bonkers, of course, but Palmer published his stories, a series of them, and the Amazing Stories started getting letters from readers all over the United States saying that they had heard the same voices and were getting the same information. And Palmer was able to increase the circulation of the magazine Amazing Stories by well over 50,000, which was unheard of for a pulp magazine. And it ran for about 5 or 6 years, I guess, at Amazing Stories, until Ziff Davis started to get some flack from the regular science fiction readers because they threatened to cancel their subscriptions, and they just thought that it was just hogwash. And so Ziff Davis finally told Palmer to cool it and not to publish any of these stories anymore. But I guess Palmer sort of got even because he went out on his own and started his own little publishing empire. And the first magazine he put out in 1946 was Fate.
Wow. Yeah,
Which is still published not very frequently, but it still comes out to this day. And he continued with the Shaver mystery. And then later on, he started a magazine called Flying Saucers from Other Worlds. And as far as I can recall, he was the first to actually talk about this, the holes at the North and the South Pole. In fact, he had, collected information from a number of polar explorers who said that as they reached the North or the South Pole, they had actually run into green valleys and animals that were supposed to have been extinct on the planet for thousands of years. And he took these stories seriously, and he published it in his magazine. And I guess this was his magazine was probably the first that I read on a regular basis back in the I guess maybe around 1963, 1964. And I later wrote a column for the magazine that lasted, I don't know, about maybe 7 or 8 years till the magazine finally went out of business. It was called On the Trail of the Flying Saucers. So I guess to some extent, I was influenced by his editorials and his penmanship.
Yeah, I would say in this book, The Hollow Earth, Our Hollow Earth, there's a description of Ray Palmer. It says, iconic publisher, editor, and offbeat author. Promoted some curious, sometimes extreme ideas. That sounds like he's like your role model. I mean, you've explored some.
I guess it would have been Ray Palmer, and later on, the late great Gray Barker, who wrote the first book on the Men in Black, called "They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers," and of course, we've just seen the release of the fourth Men in Black movie. Which really has nothing to do with the Men in Black, of course, of UFO infamy.
No.
You know, it's become. I wasn't too crazy about it. It's just a little too fanciful for me.
But Ray Palmer, I mean, doing amazing stories,
yeah.
And then Fate Magazine. He really made an impact in this field, and I can see how he could be a role model for you.
Well, you know, also like I say, Gray Barker, he. He published his book, They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, and he had a small publishing company, so Caesarian Press. And I guess at the age of about maybe 17, I penned my first book for him, and it was called The Shaver Mystery and the Inner Earth, which is still in print under another name. I think now it's called Subterranean Worlds Inside Earth or something like that. You know, we added to it. But it was my correspondence with Shaver and... a correspondence with other individuals who were involved in this. There was a gentleman by the name of Raymond Bernard who left New York to go and live in Brazil. He had become, I guess, influenced maybe by Palmer's writing and had done research on his own and believed that there were entrances in Brazil that led into the inner earth. And we corresponded for a while, and then he mysteriously disappeared. He was seen going into a cave one day, supposedly where he had been introduced to a group of a peaceful inner earth, a peaceful inner earth group, but never emerged again. So nobody knows exactly what happened to him, whether he, you know, fell down in the cave and just couldn't get out again, or whether these people were not as peaceful as he thought that they were, or maybe he just decided to stay. But he wrote, I guess, one of the first books on the subject called The Hollow Earth. And it was a tremendous success. In fact, he never bothered to copyright it, so a lot of people just, you know, reprinted it on their own. And it passed around hand to hand. And one thing that I've found out there, George, over the years, you know,
I'll tell you what, hold on a second, Tim. We're going to come back. I want to talk about Shaver a lot because he's an interesting character. We're talking with Timothy Green Beckley about his book, Our Hollow Earth. Back in a moment. We're talking with Timothy Green Beckley, a kind of a rock and roll UFO writer who has covered an eclectic sampling of topics that are of interest to this audience tonight. His latest work is Our Hollow Earth. We're going to get into what evidence exists to support that idea, and some pretty mind-bending theories about whether or not we are already living in a hollow earth. We just don't know it. I'll explain that when we come back here in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Tim Beckley, you covered a lot of topics, as I was just mentioning there in the break. UFOs, men in black, abductions, all kinds of things that we discuss on this program. But as you just mentioned, and I didn't realize, Hollow Earth is kind of where you started, the first story you wrote. So this new book, Our Hollow Earth, is kind of you coming full circle.
Well, you know, I guess we were all influenced to a great degree by Major Donald E. Kehoe. back in the early 1950s, he wrote a couple of potboilers books that were bestsellers. These were some of the first that were published on the subject. One of them was called Flying Saucers from Outer Space, and the second one, I think, was UFO Flying Saucers Confidential, although I think it had several different titles, so I don't know what it's available under today. But he fostered the idea that all UFOs had to be, you know, coming here from other planets. And he had, you know, some very reliable witnesses, airplane pilots who had been followed by these objects. And he wasn't much into close encounters or, you know, sightings of UFO occupants. And he totally poo-pooed the contactees and anybody. Well, there weren't too many abduction cases in those days, maybe one that I heard of. So that was about the only thing that the general public had to go on. His book sold probably a 500,000 copies. You know, they were a quarter or 35 cents in those days. And so the public, I guess, got the idea that flying saucers had to be from somewhere outside the solar system. And it's kind of weird when you look at the board of directors later for his organization. He started an organization called NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And almost all the board members of that group had affiliations with the government, which I always thought was kind of, you know, a strange or bizarre that here he was fighting for a UFO information to be released, but at the same time, he had this board of directors that was heavily weighed in by people, you know, with military backgrounds. So now, I believe myself, and this is only my personal theory, is that a lot of the things that transpired in the early days of UFOs, including the UFO crash at Roswell, were really not extraterrestrial craft, but they were craft manufactured here on Earth. And I believe that the crash at Roswell, if it really did take place, that it was a craft manufactured based on German technology. You know, after World War II, we brought over a whole slew of basically Nazi the scientists to work on our own space project. And from what we hear, that as early as maybe 1919 or 1920, they were receiving messages, channeled messages for beings from some other solar system, and had derived this technology for space flight and space travel that was totally different than the rocket propulsion that we were utilizing. And so when this object crashed at the Roswell, the government would rather have you believe, if you were going to believe that it happened at all, that these that this craft was from another planet, rather than having to admit that they were in collusion with these Nazis that they had brought over. And we're talking about not just Wernher von Braun and Hermann Oberth. We're talking about a whole team of engineers and scientists. I've heard a numbering of several thousand. I don't know if that's the case or not. So if you were going to believe, they'd rather you not believe in the flying saucers. That's what they were called in those days. There were no UFOs. But if you were going to believe in anything, you should accept the interplanetary concept and not look closer, you know, to an earthly origin. And I think that still holds true pretty much to this day, although we are starting to get some pretty thinkers, good thinkers like Jacques Vallée, who understands that there is a paranormal nature to some of these things, that they're all just not, you know, physical in our reality, that they could be coming here from a parallel universe or from another dimension or perhaps from inside the Earth.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So we'll come back to UFOs because I'd like to get your take on current events as well. But
a whole number of pilots that have told me of objects that they've seen you know, near the North and South Pole, shooting up from the ice. But we'll,
yeah,
we'll,
so that's the angle, right? The UFO connection to the what we're talking about tonight is the idea that UFOs are coming from inside the Earth. So tell me that part of the story.
Well, you know, I have, of course, you know, I've collected the sightings. Geez, I have 50 file drawers full of information and data that I've collected over the years. And, you know, I'd go to UFO conferences and all and talk to people, some of whom had their military background and all, and ask them about their sightings. And quite a few of them told me that they had witnessed. I remember one fellow, he's now deceased. I interviewed him. He was well in his 80s at the time, but he said that he had actually seen a city of lights on the ice up at the Arctic Circle, and one of the one or several of the craft that lifted off at the ice and actually circled the plane that he was piloting. Another told me about photos that were taken with these mounted gun cameras that they had inside the planes. And this was up in the North Pole as well. In fact, I was just going over some of these more recent reports, and there's one that MUFON put on their website by someone in the military who said that back in the mid-90s, he was stationed with a naval squadron in the Antarctic, and on a routine flight to the South Pole, one of the crew members brought their attention to the port side window where several objects were observed keenly keeping pace with the airplane that they were piloting. So these things do happen on a regular basis. I've even seen photographs that were taken up at the Antarctic of giant glowing objects in the sky. And I found in a book that Admiral Byrd wrote in, I think it was 1938, a description of a mysterious object in the sky that he saw on several occasions. And he said, to his way of thinking, it seemed like this light, or he called it a giant star, was actually trying to communicate with him. But then he, you know, he kind of just gave up on that theory because he couldn't prove it. But he saw it on a number of occasions, and this is part of the literature that he wrote. And in fact, there are I don't know how many. I guess he was a vociferous writer. I mean, he wrote logs and books and all kinds of maps he collected and photographs that he took. And one of them, one collection is in the University of Ohio, and another collection, I believe, is in Virginia somewhere. If someone ever had the time, I think that they should investigate these two enormous collections, because there's probably a lot of a good material in there that has never been released to the public. In fact, you know, Admiral Byrd, he had, when he went to the South Pole, he had a group of, several hundred members of the crew, and most of them were members of the Masonic Order. In fact, he started Masonic Lodge 777 at the Antarctic, and he swore his men, his crew, to total secrecy. He had his own little secret society, and they were sworn to secrecy and told never to tell without his permission anything that happened on any of these expeditions.
Well, let's talk about Admiral Byrd for a couple of minutes. He's mm-hmm. like, you know, a very prominent person, a hero in many ways, who had kind of some dark connections that you and your team explore in this book, including connections to Nazis.
Well, he was invited in 1938 by the Germans to form an expedition to the Antarctic, but he refused to do that. I mean, he did not take a part in it. And later on, I guess within a year or so, the Germans did go off and establish a base at the South Pole in an area that I believe that Norway had claimed as their own years before. And I guess the Nazis just took over the area. They planted like 13 or 14 poles in the ground with German flags with the swastika on it, and claimed that part of the Antarctica as their own. And Hitler thought, or at least some of the Germans believed, that there was a base, maybe a UFO base or some sort of inner Earth opening that was, occupied, or that this Aryan race lived in. And they also thought this about Tibet. They sent a team of archaeologists up to Tibet to go into some of the caverns and all there, looking for this race of supermen that they thought were Aryans and all. I don't know whether they were successful or not. Apparently not. But there is a mystery about the South Pole, and there are many people who believe to this day that the Germans actually established a base there. And even Byrd, when he went up there at one point, he had an expedition that was supposed to last for 9 months. It was Project High Jump, I believe it was called.
Yeah, it was a big military operation,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, big military thing. And apparently, even though the expedition was supposed to last for 9 months, he came back after about 6 or 7 weeks. And really was kind of a close-lipped about what had happened up there. There are some that think that the U.S. military, because he did say it was mainly a military expedition. There are some say that they went to close down this Nazi base that might have been established there during the end of the war, or they might have had a battle with the UFOs of some sort. I don't know. It's all a mystery, and of course, like I say, his men were sworn to secrecy, and he never really would talk about what happened. Although he did say on a number of occasions that he was convinced that if we ever were in another world war, it would be by objects coming over the pole, from one pole to the other. But he never really explained what he meant by that.
Right. So, you know, there is some evidence, as you explore in this book, that the Nazis did send an expedition there, that we do know they were scouring the world for all kinds of unique objects that, you know, mm-hmm. sort of right out of Indiana Jones, and mystical objects and mystical powers and trying to engage dark forces, I guess, for what was to come. But the story, as told in various versions, is that the Nazis went to the South Pole, maybe found an entrance into the Hollow Earth, and that's where they escaped to after the Third Reich came crashing down. And I guess one version of the story is that they're flying advanced craft out of there now. That's what we're seeing in the sky. Now, I know you tend to, when you write your books, you and your team, Sean Castile, et cetera, you cast a wide net. You don't really commit to any one theory,
my background is that of a journalist. You know, I figure I let the people, I do my own research, and like you say, Sean Castile, Tim Schwartz, and Tim Quidlin, a lot of Tims involved in this field, you know, do research, and we put together, well, my background is that of a magazine editor, see, so I put these books together as if we were doing an anthology, and there are some people who have different points of view, but at the end, we all come to some mighty conclusion. But Byrd did make a couple of statements. He said at one point, I'd like to see the land beyond the North Pole as it is a center of the great unknown. And at the South Pole, he once called it the land of everlasting mystery, which I guess you could really say that that it is.
So here's my question. If there are giant entrances to the Hollow Earth at the poles, why don't we see them? Why don't we see them with satellites?
Well, actually, we have. I mentioned that Tim Quidlin, who is a Fortean researcher, he wrote a book a couple of years ago, I think, A Weird Nevada. And he's done a lot of research on Admiral Byrd as well as the inner Earth. And in the book, there's actually a photograph, NASA, official NASA photograph, that shows, I would believe, the North Pole and what looks to be like a big entranceway there. It's just a big black area up at the pole. And in fact, I think on the other night on the History Channel, Linda Moulton Howe was on, and they interviewed a couple of people, military personnel, who had had experiences up at the polls, and they claimed that they have photographs, which they showed on the air, of what looked to be like giant crevices or tunnels or caves that could be used for UFO entranceways.
Yeah, I've spoken to Linda about that as well. She has some witnesses that she considers to be pretty credible talking about
that.
Well,
they seem to be from the interview. Of course, their faces were in shadow and their voices disguised. But, I mean, it seemed to be a credible interviews, and it does go hand in hand with what I've, you know, discovered on my own. So I don't see any reason to think otherwise.
So what's your sense of UFOs? Because you think that there, maybe Roswell was Nazi technology, something that crashed. Does that mean you think that what we're seeing in the skies now is also derived from Nazi technology?
I believe UFOs are quite a few different things. I mean, when you say UFO, what are we talking about? We're talking about unidentified flying objects. Some of them aren't even flying. I mean, some of them are seen very close to the ground. There are some that even intermingle with the individuals. They come into their homes. We have these orange spears now that are being seen. We have people who claim that they've had religious experiences when they've had these UFO sightings. I mean, there are all kinds of objects here. So to say that one comes from the inner earth and one comes from a parallel universe, it's kind of hard to pinpoint this. We don't know who's inside the objects for the most part. But now, there have been a number of UFO sightings, especially in the early 1950s. There was a gentleman by the name of Reinhold Schmidt, who was a grain buyer, and he was working out around Kearney, Nebraska. And he had a sighting late one afternoon or maybe early evening of this craft, and he was invited inside. And he said that the beings, who looked remarkably human, in fact, in most of these early cases involving UFO contactees, they looked pretty much like they could be walking around here on the outside of the Earth and be easily, not recognized for being aliens or extraterrestrials. And I guess if they were coming from inside the Earth, they would more likely to look like us than if they were coming from some far off planet.
All right, Tim, I'm going to ask you to take a break. We got to go to a short break now. When we come back, I want to ask about some of these sightings, and then I want to try to pin you down on whether you think there really is a hollow Earth, and if so, how is the sun down there? I don't quite understand it, but we're going to hear your take on it